You open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
It's really bittersweet, as you can imagine, because this is Paul's dream come true and he's not here to see it.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. When Lucy Kalanithi lost her husband Paul to lung cancer, she found herself dealing with her grief in unexpected ways, including taking a nap on his grave.
I was so used to sleeping in Paul's arms next to Paul, and that was sort of like the place where Paul is now. So it's like I'm literally just like lying on the ground wishing that Paul was closer.
When neurosurgeon Paul Kalanithi was diagnosed with cancer, he decided to write a memoir. He didn't live to see his book, When Breath Becomes Air, published, but it turned into a New York Times number one bestseller. His widow, Lucy Kalanithi, helped finish the book after Paul couldn't continue. I asked Lucy how Paul came up with the book's title.
So the title of the book, When Breath Becomes Air, is from this little Elizabethan poem that's really short by Greville, and it starts out and the first line is, "You that seek what life is in death, now find it air that once was breath." So it's talking about the immediate moment of dying. You know, when you're born, air becomes breath, and when you die, breath becomes air. And so Paul had this little book of poetry that he was carrying around when he was sick. He was diagnosed he was 36, and he was just finishing his residency training in neurosurgery when he was diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And he lived for 22 months and died right before he turned 38.
Mm-hmm. And what year was that he died?
He died in March 2015.
Okay.
So he died 16 months ago, almost.
Okay.
And as a child and as a young adult, dreamed of being a writer and always thought he'd be a writer.
Right.
Never thought he'd be a doctor, and then certainly never thought he'd be a neurosurgeon. But he was really interested in the brain and the mind and human stories, and sort of became a neurosurgeon as another way of getting at that.
Right.
Anyway, so he, after he was diagnosed, he started writing as a way to cope. And so the book is divided into two sections. It's first about Paul's life, briefly as a kid, and then mostly as he's becoming a doctor and a surgeon. And the first half of the book is called In Perfect Health I Begin, which is a little segment from Walt Whitman's Song of Myself.
Mm-hmm.
And the second half is called Cease Not Till Death. And it's about the moment of his diagnosis up until the last thing he wrote.
Right.
And then the epilogue to the book is by me, and I wrote it after he died, and it's talking about the way Paul died, and then what's been happening since he died, and it's so it sort of tells that whole story.
How big has this book been in the United States? I mean, if you were to step back and say, why has this book had such an impact? It's been on the Times list for 6 months as of mm-hmm. yesterday. It's been number one for a long time. Mm-hmm. How does that make you feel, and why is it so popular?
Yeah, so it's really bittersweet, as you can imagine, because this is Paul's dream come true, and he's not here to see it. It was number one on the New York Times list for 20 weeks, and it's like, their list comes out on Wednesday, and I would look at it again and just be like, oh, this is so awesome, you know? I'm so proud of him. And he secured the book deal with Random House before he died. So he died in March, and the December before that, in 2014, he got the book deal, and he was so excited about it. And one of his friends came to visit us right after he got the book deal and said, Paul seems sort of cocky talking about his book deal. And he was not a cocky guy. He was so sweet and gentle. But I remember being like, I hope he feels cocky, because he's literally dying and he knows it. And if you're dying and you feel really cocky about your life prospects,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, yay. You
know? Right.
And that is how it was. I mean, he was writing and he knew he wouldn't be there to see it, but that it would extend into the future, and it's a message for our daughter and a, you know, gift to our family and to the reader. And so to see it be received well is just amazing. And then I think we're at this kind of interesting cultural inflection point, and I see this as a doctor too, where, you know, there are all these taboos about talking about death, and we're sort of realizing mm-hmm. that isn't actually helping us, and isn't actually helping us be able to face.
Why do you think we have those taboos about death? Especially since we've been experiencing almost 15 years of war and combat. At the same time, it would seem counterintuitive that we don't want to talk about it.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's like your guess is as good as mine. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's funny because I think all through history, death was everywhere. You know, like people, like many children are dying and women are dying in childbirth and people are dying at home because there is nowhere else to die. And now it's like death and illness are sort of hidden. Like mm-hmm. you can choose not to see them and everything's mm-hmm. sort of sterile. And then there's like the whole internet perfection scene, you mm-hmm. know, if you're on social media. And I think like the grittiness and what's actually happening in our lives and in our families is much more complicated and, mm-hmm. you know, messy and beautiful than this like perfect picture, but we don't always share it with people outside our families or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think, I don't know, I'm just guessing.
It's a good guess because I know your sister is a blogger. She uh-huh. has a book called Cup of Joe. Her name is Joanna Goddard, uh-huh. right? And I know that growing up, she did ballet and you did sports uh-huh. and you're identical twins.
We're fraternal.
Oh, fraternal, okay. But you always thought it was crazy that she was so personal in her blog, mm-hmm. read by millions. Mm-hmm. And yet here you are now being read by millions, your own epilogue. Yeah. Don't you think it's interesting that somehow the personal becomes universal, the
yes.
more singular you get?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
You found that, yeah?
Yeah, at first I did, so Random House said, would you like to write an epilogue to the book and you can go into as much detail about the last days of Paul's life as you're comfortable with. And at first I did it out of a sense of obligation, like I'll do exactly what they say to make the book what they think is a good book. And then I was like, you know, if Paul could have written about his death, he would have done it. Like it was part of the story and he would have,
right.
you know, he wouldn't have been afraid to do that. And then I think, so as I was writing it, at first I asked for a ghostwriter. I was telling Anne this. I was like, I'm not a writer.
I was gonna say.
I'm a doctor. How am I gonna do this? And it's really personal. And so they set me up with a ghostwriter and she came and flew out to California and we spent 3 days looking at pictures and talking about Paul. It was really amazing just as far as like, and mm-hmm. it's this woman, Emily Rapp, who wrote a book called The Still Point of the Turning World, and her son died of Tay-Sachs disease. Mm-hmm. And before I met her, they said, she's unshockable. Like she will just sit there, you can say anything you want. She's not gonna like make a pained face. She's just gonna be like, and like be in it. And then I picked her up from the plane and she was like swearing like a sailor. And she's this beautiful writer, just like stunning writer. And I was like, this person is like interesting and real, you know? And then she just was in it. And then she sort of helped me devise a structure for the epilogue. And as soon as we started writing, I was like, oh, I can't give this away to
sure.
somebody else.
Right.
Like suddenly I need to write it too, you know? And mm-hmm. so then I was writing the section about when Paul died and she said, put as many sensory details as you can.
Right.
So tell me what the light looked like when it's coming in the room and what are the sounds and what are the beeps in the hospital room. And she said, the more detail and the more personal and visceral, the more universal it'll feel
right.
to read it. And I was like, oh, that's so weird and like surprising. And she's like, yeah, but trust me, it's really true. And I learned a lot about writing, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And I was telling you before, I hate writing, and I'm like, I'm not a writer, I hate writing. And now I know writers hate writing too, so it's
yes.
like, anybody can be a writer.
speechless. I'll have to think about that as you do. What's the book about, though? I mean, let me tell you. I want to know your story. I mean, we know Paul. We talk about you talk about Paul a lot, but you are an equal journeyer in this. And here's my take, that he's trying to wrench meaning at the very moment he apprehends his own finitude. He's reaching for some sense of immortality, mm-hmm. not in any kind of egotistical way, but if he hadn't written this book, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's so interesting about what we try to do, that lean in around the campfire of this story, which is what we're doing right now, mm-hmm. and around his life and the nodes that he created, the poetic. This really to me is, by the way, all of you, it's such a fantastic book. It's really a prose poem to life. It's to a sense of life. This is a book about how to live, not how to die. There are a lot of those books, right? So that's what I'm taking from it. And there's all this poetry in this book, too. There's all kinds of contemporary and modern. Do you think he was really trying to create a poetic prose poem, that he was really going for literature? He was really searching here, wasn't he, to create a record?
Yeah, sure.
For you and for his daughter.
Right, and then he's drawing on not only his experience as a neurosurgeon, but then his background in literature, because there are tons of allusions throughout the book, or frank quotes or whatever he's drawing from literature. And it was funny because there are a couple of little podcasts that he did, and I was listening to one of them the other day. It's just nice to go back and listen, you know? It's nice to have this book, it's nice to have the podcast. And he says this thing where, he says, I think part of the meaning of our lives is if we can add something to the greater human story, and if we can become part of the narrative that we're building together. He says something like that. And as he was saying it in the podcast, I'm listening to it and I'm like, he's part of it. He added his voice to a narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Like this, the immortality that you're describing. It's like he did that thing that he hoped to do. And then I think, you know, his plan was to be a neurosurgeon for 30 years and then maybe write in his retirement. And then he gets diagnosed with cancer and he's 36 and he's like, you know, these are the last years of my life. What am I going to do in the last years of my life? And it would turn out to be right. And I think, you know, there's a chance he's like touching more people, you know, than he would have, or, you know, as a physician. So it's interesting it's sort of a consolation to me.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. There's a certain sense that the book is coming out of a very genuine place for him, that it's, you know, you can tell that when you're writing sometimes, you know when it's real. I don't know if you felt that way in the epilogue. Probably you did. Mm-hmm. You know, there's moments when I'm just on here. Mm-hmm. Maybe you feel that way when you're a doctor too, like you're really connecting with somebody. Mm-hmm. Like you're just listening, you're in the moment, and you're trying to heal them. I've been watching, you know, since you've been in town, so many people have come up to you and told you their stories. And it's got to be somewhat of a burden, but also a sense of joy in encapsulating all this. How does that feel to you, you know, being now the...
Yeah, it's great. Paul was a writer and I'm a talker. So it's sort of like, I feel like doing a book tour and like what you were describing, getting to say these things out loud. You know, we often don't get a chance to share our grief, you know, with other people in a way that's outside of our family or support group or whatever. And so, somebody dies and then people are afraid to say their name, you know? So it's like people say Paul's name all the time. Everybody I meet wants to talk about Paul. And it's actually really helpful.
It is,
and healing
okay.
for me. Yeah, no, it's
great. You don't ever feel like, oh, come on, I want to talk about me, or it was hard for me. I mean, I'm not saying you do, but...
I sneak it in there if I want to say it. Yeah. And if it didn't feel good, I wouldn't do it. Like, I literally, like, wouldn't do it.
You know, I mean, I think I should back up a moment, because people may not know. I mean, you just talked... you're working 80 hours a week. Uh-huh. He's becoming just a brain surgeon. I mean... and... And suddenly he gets this diagnosis, and the whole, you know, he writes, I thought maybe someday I'd have a boat or a house, or not that he would have all these material things, but he was almost on the mountaintop, and you guys were really working, you didn't have any children, and you tell him, though, something, like a week before he's diagnosed, right, or a week after?
Week before,
A week
goodness.
Before.
Yeah.
You deliver some news that nobody really wants to hear, and what is that news?
Yeah, so he's... He starts out the beginning of the book in the prologue talking about how we were going through a rough patch in our marriage. And I remember watching him write it and I was like, I appreciate this narrative device that you're starting the book with, this salacious thing.
Like, salacious.
It's like a catchy first sentence or whatever, where your wife is like, I'm gonna move out for a week. So it was a very rough time. You know, it's hard. I think the secret of marriage when you get married is it's hard and you keep working at it. And the super romantic thing is like, not the dramatic kiss at your wedding, it's the fact that you wake up every day and continue to choose to be together, right? It's very romantic. And
what's hard about it though?
Well, I mean,
What were you finding hard at the time?
Oh.
If you don't mind.
Yeah. I have to remember, I have to like think about it because like this, the swell of what came after
things
like overshadows it, you know?
Right.
Yeah, although, like you say, it all got out on the table right before he got diagnosed, which was really good because then we're sort of just like
Was it after at the end of the workday? What were you doing? Is it in the kitchen? Were you having?
Oh man, I don't. It was on a weekend.
Do you remember what you said to him?
I mean, he wrote it in the book. I mean, basically, I said, I don't know. I just said we were missing each other's attempts to connect. That's what I think that's what I think happened. And we had kind of different communication styles. Like he wrote things in the book that are more intimate than he could have said out loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted him to say them out loud in out loud words. And
did you tell him that?
Yeah. And so it's just like, you know, I think, and then I think it can be calm where you stop giving each other the benefit of the doubt. And that
right.
is like that's a scary turning point, you know, where you're.
What does that mean? What's the benefit of the doubt?
I don't know. I remember reading this thing about marriage that said, if you get to the stage where you're rolling your eyes at each other, it's actually like the kiss of death. It's like disgust. Disgust is the kiss of death. But it's like, it's really, I sort of relate to it.
Oh my God, I've had this conversation.
Right?
Yeah.
It's like, I know. But it's
I'm
like,
never going to roll my eyes again.
No, you can't. Right? Because it's like if you're, I don't know, it's like you're not engaging anymore. You're just kind of like, I'm out. And so,
wait.
But like,
I hear a laugh in the audience.
I'm just going to become a marriage counselor, I think. That's my next career. Yeah.
All right, so enough about you. this eye-rolling thing. So it's the weekend.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it just kind of all got out on the table because I think we basically were both like, I love you. Why are we so lonely? What are we going to do? And, you know, he's working literally 110 hours a week.
Wow.
And I'm working like pretty darn hard, although not that hard, so mm-hmm. lonely. And anyway, it just sort of like came to a head. And then we sort of started drawing back together. And I was like, I've got us in couples therapy next week. And then during that day, he gets admitted to the hospital to get diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And I like didn't even email the lady, obviously, to say we're not coming to our couples. I mean, just like the whole thing changed. But thankfully, we did get it all out mm-hmm. on the table right before, because it would have been hard,
sure.
I think, to suddenly like navigate needing each other, but then not having the like raw vocabulary anymore, you know? And instead it was just like, I wouldn't say cancer was the thing that saved our marriage, although he makes that joke in the book. It's more like it just cemented it, you know? And then looking back, it's like I would have given anything for that marriage not to end. You know,
right.
It ended with him dying. But at this, you know, it's like I learned a lot about.
Sure.
You know, that.
He makes a reference in the book about it would be, giving cancer would be a wonderful gift to give to a young man or something. To clarify, nothing
right.
clarifies the mind like the news.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, he says, wouldn't cancer be the perfect gift to the
right.
young man who had wanted to understand death? He's really interested in death, right. always.
So the question is, so this thing happened. So you, there's this trajectory in your life. It's the life you expect, but you end up with the life you get. Mm-hmm. And it seems like you really love the life you got, even mm-hmm. though now it includes not having Paul physically mm-hmm. with you.
Yeah.
The question is, though, how can we achieve that kind of the moral equivalency of that in our life?
Mm-hmm.
How can we achieve that clarity and that sense of epiphany without having this diagnosis? Have you come to any conclusions mm-hmm. about that, you know, as you've traveled around the country?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is like a victory to love the life you get, right? Because
mm-hmm.
a lot of it you can't change, and you only have one. So it's sort of like great if you can. And I read this thing once that said, pain plus non-acceptance of pain equals suffering. And at first I didn't get it. I was just like,
which is a very
what?
Buddhist thing
like,
to say.
It's
yeah.
super Buddhist, right? It's like, but this not, must not be this way. And then I was sort of like, oh, I get it. You know, I get what that means now.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it is just the ability to tolerate discomfort. So, you know, some
Did
of
you
it you just have
it?
To tolerate. Yeah, like discomfort and uncertainty and they're really painful. And I think some of what helped us, which is sort of the best part and the worst part, is that we were both doctors, so we knew the prognosis and we could see sort of the advancing debility, and we just sort of, I was just like, I will hold him when he dies. Like, as soon as we looked at his CAT scan together, so nobody delivered the news to us in an unmediated, artful way. It was more like we just looked at it. And meanwhile, we had seen a lot of people, like, you know, and so I think we had seen it. We'd seen, like, sure, these really sad things happen to multiple families, and this was sort of like, oh, like, now we get this life, you know, like, it's our turn to do it. So, yeah, I don't know if I have
that's
a really
an extraordinary
good
thing to say, though. It's our turn to do it. I mean, and I think Paul meant it. When I read it in the book, it seems sincere, like, I've accepted this.
Yeah.
There's a very spiritual sense to this book. So many layers to it. There's the medical layer, there's the family layer, the relationship layer, the spiritual one. It's working on so many levels. And also, it reads like butter. It's short. I mean, there's something very healing about the process of reading this book. By that I mean, he says something fascinating. Who knew? Can you help me out here? He says something like, "Who knew we could be so great together?"
Oh, yeah.
What's this quote?
Yeah. I mean, he said, "Who even knew how good we would be together?" Because we met on there in our first year of medical school.
In 2003 at Yale.
Yeah.
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 Let's just take a moment there. Did you win him in an auction, a charity
auction?
Oh
yeah, yeah. That's not in the book. You've done your homework somehow. Yeah.
I just play a writer.
Well, your wife's an investigative journalist.
And he dressed up as in a gorilla suit.
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
So he was really funny. At first, when I first met him in medical school, I was like, oh, he's this like intellectual dude, and he wants to be a doctor, and he's like really smart. I knew he was smart. He was leading a bioethics reading group with another student, and as extracurricularly, as if we didn't have enough to read, and he's just like, and then I realized that in his medical student ID, he was wearing this huge mustache, it wasn't a handlebar mustache, it was like this big, bushy, weird-looking mustache, and it turned out that it was a fake mustache that he stuck on, and he'd been a sketch comedy writer in college, and he got in a lot of trouble doing it in college, and then he thought that medical school was going to make him boring and like straight edge. And I mean, he was sort of both. He was like really reverent and high achieving, but also this other thing. And so he as like sort of a social anodyne, like pulls this giant mustache out and puts on it, sort of lopsided. And then he didn't quite realize this. I think he thought it was for like a face sheet of the medical students. It was also his ID. So he's in the hospital like, you know, asking for his neurosurgical letters of recommendation 3.5 years later, and he's like, and he's got this huge mustache, and I think people are like, you know, is he a recent immigrant from India, and like, what is this like thing? And it's like, anyway, so as soon as I learned this kind of thing about him, he was like always kind of doing that sort of stuff. Again, he was like very, although that said, I'm going to tell one other thing. His resume when he applied to medical school was full of all of this comedy writing stuff that he had done. And he got interviewed, and the person interviewing him at Yale said, you know, I really love this list of things you've done in comedy, but none of your letters of recommendation say anything about your sense of humor.
Right.
Why is that? And he was like, that's an awesome question. Like, that's the best question I've been asked. And he said, you know, I'm a bit of a different person in different situations. Like, when I'm being a doctor, I'm not hilarious all the time, and I'm not playing jokes. And this book feels a little like that to me. It's like there's this whole shadow version of Paul that's just really funny, and there's little slices of it in there. He's a little cheeky throughout the book, but again, it's weightier than a fake mustache.
But what about how did you win him in an auction?
So at Yale, there's a medical school event called the Hunger and Homelessness Auction, and they have a big silent auction, and then on the side they have all these little fundraising things, and one of them is They're called date boxes, and you literally decorate a shoe, you're a medical student, you decorate a shoebox with a date that you will take someone on, and it doesn't have to be romantic. So you can say, I'm a really good skier, I'll teach you how to ski, or I'm going to come to your house and I'll make dinner for two with a candlelight and whatever. And Paul's was called the Guns and Freaks date, and it was...
You went right towards it.
It was a Barnum & Bailey Circus Museum in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and a shooting range nearby. And I was like,
I'm so glad I asked this question, because
I really like this dude. But like the person, our friend Brendan put in 20 tickets because he wants to go to the Guns and Freaks date with Paul and like shoot guns with Paul. You know, they have this budding friendship. And so, and then I put in one ticket and I won the date. And then we went on the date and I hated holding the gun. I was like, I don't even want to be here. And then we didn't end up going to the Freaks Museum. We went out to dinner. So it ended up being a different date. But literally, he was like, I think he liked me first. And I was like, I think he's great. But he was really happy that I got the ticket.
Yeah. He's like, what was his friend's name?
Brendan.
Like, Brendan. Lucy, yeah, you win.
The winner.
Wow. A guy with a fake mustache at a pistol range. You're right. He's very serious in this book.
Yeah, but in this book, he's like the late Dr. Paul Kalanithi.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. But it's right. Like in real life, he's like a really, alive person, like you were saying.
So you have this journey, the diagnosis, and then you want to move out for a week or something needs to change in the marriage, and then his treatment begins, and then you just make one other really fascinating decision.
Can I read about it?
Sure, yeah, go right ahead.
Because I really like this conversation, and it's like a real conversation we had. Flush in the face of mortality, many decisions became compressed, urgent, and unreceding. Foremost among them for us, should Lucy and I have a child? I assume that's what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Even if our marriage had been strained toward the end of my residency, we had always remained very much in love. Our relationship was still deep in meaning, a shared and evolving vocabulary about what mattered. It had been something we'd always wanted, and we were both impelled by the instinct to do it still, to add another chair to our family's table. Both of us yearning to be parents, we each thought of the other. Lucy hoped I had years left, but understanding my prognosis, she felt that the choice, whether to spend my remaining time as a father, should be mine. "What are you most afraid of or sad about?" she asked me one night as we were lying in bed. "Leaving you," I told her. I knew a child would bring joy to the whole family, and I couldn't bear to picture Lucy husbandless and childless after I died, but I was adamant that the decision ultimately be hers. She would likely have to raise the child on her own after all, and to care for both of us as my illness progressed. "Will having a newborn distract from the time we have together?" she asked. "Don't you think saying goodbye to your child will make your death more painful?" "Wouldn't it be great if it did?" I said. Lucy and I both felt that life wasn't about avoiding suffering. Years ago, it had occurred to me that Darwin and Nietzsche agreed on one thing. The defining characteristic of the organism is striving. Describing life otherwise was like painting a tiger without stripes. We talked it over. Our families gave their blessing. We decided to have a child. We would carry on living instead of dying.
That's beautiful. Can you talk about that phrase, wouldn't it be great if it did?
Yeah.
What did he mean by that? Because this is, it's not confusing, but that's Paul's voice that you're reading in.
Yeah.
So what did he mean?
I love it. And I remember asking him this question because, there were all these reasons to, it was a hard decision to decide whether I have a child. But don't you think it'll cause you more pain to have to say goodbye to your child? We're gonna have a child, presumably we're gonna fall in love, and then you're gonna have another person to leave. And wouldn't it be great if it did, is sort of saying, the depth of meaning that you are inviting. And you know, nobody decides to have a child because they think it's going to be easy, presumably.
Right.
It's because it's meaningful. And so he was sort of getting at that, you know, if I have more to leave that I don't want to leave, like, lucky me.
Right. Interesting.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up in the second half, more of Doug Standen's conversation with Lucy Kalanithi.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Standen, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to my conversation with Lucy Kalanithi.
Do you want to read another section, or?
Sure.
What would you like to read?
Well, so there's a part that I just really like that's about climbing to the top of a mountain near Lake Tahoe, and it's just pretty prose, sort of. Do you want me to read a tiny bit
Do you
about
remember
that?
Him?
Or you want me to read a different bit?
No, that's a great bit. But before I want to set it up, Paul is really ill when he's writing this, right? Mm. And yet at one point you get him gloves because his fingers begin to crack,
yeah.
And he's typing on a laptop, I presume.
Yeah.
Describe that for us. What's the room look like? Is he in a bedroom? Oh. Is he propped up in bed?
Yeah, so great question. So he wrote most of the book while he was doing like traditional IV chemo. The first 10 months after his diagnosis, he was on a chemo pill. That's a novel therapy, came out even since we graduated medical school, much easier to take. And the chance of maybe living 5 years or 10 instead of one or two. And then that stopped working. So at that point, he knew his prognosis was probably around a year, and the treatments get harder to do and less likely to help. So he's doing chemo, and he's losing more weight, and he's in and out of the hospital a little bit. And then he's writing all the time. And he wasn't sort of like doing it on the side or doing it alone. It's like he's doing it in our living room in this armchair that I got that it was sort of like a Lazy Boy recliner, mm-hmm. that was automated, so he could just press a button. Because at a certain point, like leaning over and pulling the lever to move a Lazy Boy is like kind of hard, mm-hmm. if you're really debilitated. And so he was writing there a lot, or he was writing in bed, and then he's sort of revisiting all these periods of his life. And even though he looks like he's, you know, thin and wan, and his hair is much thinner, he was so vital. You know, mm-hmm. it was sort of this really interesting contrast because his mind was still totally engaged. Mm-hmm. So that he's writing, and our daughter's there, and
she's born.
I mean, I guess she was born in July, and he started writing in probably April.
Wow.
Or March.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for those of us who do write and complain about writer's block, this is just a tableau of an epic, heroic effort to actually write against all odds.
Right. And it's, you know? Actually, it's funny. Yeah, it really was writing against all odds. That's right. Because he's sort of racing time, obviously. And then, and there was more he probably would have and wanted to write. And then the fact of writing, so some of it is, if you're in the hospital or you're in the chemo suite, you can't always write when you want to. And then he ended up on a stimulant that was kind of similar to Ritalin. And it was because he was so fatigued from cancer. Mm-hmm. And then he was on pain medication, which make you sleepy. So even just to focus, you know, his doctors were saying, what's most important to you? How can we help you? And he's like, I know I'm really sick, but I'm writing this book. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what I want to be doing. So it was really amazing because people were sort of tailoring his medications even, mm-hmm. so that he could write. Hmm.
So go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So he's talking about when he worked at Stanford Sierra Camp, which is this beautiful camp where he was an undergrad student, and then he's part of the staff at this alumni family camp. Nights during a full moon, the light flooded the wilderness, so it was possible to hike without a headlamp. We would hit the trail at 2 a.m., summiting the nearest peak, Mount Tilak, just before sunrise, the clear, starry night reflected in the flat, still lakes spread below us. And then we would sit and watch as the first hint of sunlight, a light tinge of day blue, would leak out of the eastern horizon, slowly erasing the stars. The day sky would spread wide and high until the first ray of sun made an appearance. The morning commuters began to animate the distant South Lake Tahoe roads. But craning your head back, you could see the day's blue darken halfway across the sky, and to the west, the night remained yet unconquered, pitch black, stars in full glimmer, the full moon still pinned in the sky. To the east, the full light of day beamed toward you. To the west, night reigned with no hint of surrender. No philosopher can explain the sublime better than this, standing between day and night. It was as if this were the moment God said, "Let there be light." You could not help but feel your speck-like existence against the immensity of the mountain, the earth, the universe, and yet still feel your own 2 feet on the talus, reaffirming your presence amid the grandeur.
Hmm. Nice.
Pretty, right?
Yeah, it is. Writing that passage and passages like that becomes his consuming mission. So at a certain point, he knows I have a year to live. Mm-hmm. How long did it, and so this is what he's doing now. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, it's so interesting because it's that question about, and I don't know if you ever think about this, but you have one story left to tell. What would it be? And what would be the one story you would tell that would keep you alive?
Ooh.
You know, and that's the story you need to tell. And that's something I've thought about a lot, and, you know, as I try to think about and then he actually does it. The story's keeping him alive. Katie, your daughter, who will be 2 July 4th, is, as you say, growing kind of biologically in you, and he's growing the book, and the house is filled with this sense of new stories growing. I mean, to me, this is a celebration, I don't know if you agree, but it's a celebration of storytelling and the power to bind people.
Oh, yeah.
Together.
Yeah.
And which is why we need this more than ever, these books and these stories.
Yeah,
and
that's what Paul felt, right? It's he was literally able to face his mortality because of being a reader. Like he carried around these books like little talisman, you know. Oh, let me tell you, I'm interrupting you.
Oh no, no, really.
Well, and I also want to know what story you would tell.
Okay.
Yeah, but I was just going to tell you, the day he got diagnosed. He'd been getting this kind of sequential series of tests with his primary care doctor, and the final one was a chest x-ray that showed nodules all over his lungs. And nodules, like, often means tumors. Maybe it means tuberculosis, and we were kind of like, please, tuberculosis, you know, it's like, that's, you know. And then we went to the hospital for him to get expedited workup. I was packing for the hospital, and I packed him like socks and the insurance card and stuff like that. And he packed books, actually, and he hadn't read a novel in a while. He was working as a neurosurgeon, but he took Being and Time by Heidegger and Solzhenitsyn's novel, Cancer Ward, and Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And it's literally like this little swath of philosophy and religion and literature.
Wow.
And he literally, it was like, yeah. And there, so, and the reason I remember is because I'd remember it, and then there was this sort of stark contrast, like this tray, his hospital bed tray, and then it's got like the little pitcher with the straw in it, and whatever, and these 3 books, and it was just sort of like, that's the talisman, you know, that's the amulet.
He grew up in Kingman, Arizona, was the valedictorian of his high school class, and, you know, his mother was worried, I think, according to Paul, that he was doing drugs or the things of parents, but he was really, he said the most intoxicating thing I was reading was romantic poetry, you know.
Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, when you learn, you know, I can see why he was such an attractive, appealing person.
Mm-hmm.
Later, when he sells the book, tell us about that day.
So. Yeah.
Life changes, I'm writing the book, now I've got to finish the book. What are you doing during this time? Are you working? How are you taking care of yourself? I mean, what would you tell us about the things that we need to do
Oh.
You know, I mean, what were you doing?
If someone gets sick. So initially, we both went back to work because he wanted to. I think a lot of people, you get diagnosed with terminal cancer, a lot of people quit their jobs and literally never walk in the door again. And that's totally fine. You know, I think, like you were saying, cancer sort of clarifies what's important to you some of the time. And he wanted to be a neurosurgeon initially, so we went back. And then, so we worked for a while. And then when he got too sick and he needed to do chemo, I went on like family medical leave and family disability. And then I went on maternity leave. And I took a pretty long, relatively long maternity leave for the United States. I took 5 months, which was really great. And then after that, he was really pretty sick. So then I was on family disability leave mm-hmm. again. So there was a period of 10 months or so where he certainly wasn't working and I wasn't really working either.
Except in the home, just
yeah,
you working on the book, really.
Yeah, and like taking care of all of his medical stuff. And then, and he told people, he said, I want everybody to take care of Lucy so she can take care of me. And that kind of happened. Like it was actually, that was good advice too, actually.
Sure.
And then for me, it was like the nuts and bolts stuff, literally, like I will eat 3 meals a day. I will sleep 8 hours at night if I can. I will exercise every other day. Like the things that I know are helpful for me for stress, you know, it's like.
What are those?
If you're too stressed to do those things, like.
Yeah.
Exercise, it's like that's when you have to exercise, you know.
You're a runner in mm-hmm. college and a swimmer and you did crew at Dartmouth. You were an undergrad at Dartmouth, right?
None of these was varsity. Yeah.
Right.
That's you make it sound so fancy. I know. yes, I like running.
and you go to Yale too, to medical school. Uh-huh. Right, which is where you meet Paul. Mm-hmm. And you're a doctor now, you're seeing patients at Stanford. What's your title there?
I'm a clinical assistant professor.
Mm-hmm. You teach and also mm-hmm. serve patients, right? And mm-hmm. is that something you want to plan to keep doing? Does it still get you up out of bed in the morning? And
yeah, it's great. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
And what, do you then like, what do you like being about a doctor, you know?
I mean, I remember being right at the beginning of medical school, and I was like, this is the first time I've used every single part of my brain at one time.
Really?
It's so awesome. It's so awesome. Because it's like you're thinking, I sort of think of my job as like I'm a translator in a way. Because it's really just like two people sitting in a room and one of them knows more about medicine than the other one. But then yet the patient is the expert. You're the expert on your life and you're the expert on your own body. And then I can tell you some news that I've found out about your body and how you might proceed, you know? But it's like, I think that, but that job is really challenging in all these dimensions because connecting to somebody and getting their trust either quickly or over time and then knowing all the medical information or where to find it and then knowing how to put it into words that someone who doesn't speak that language mm-hmm. can understand and then figuring out what it is that's really important to them and then helping them try to match that up with what the options are. It's so awesome. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. What do you do for fun? I mean, that sounds fun.
Well, now, I sleep right now.
You sleep, but I mean, when yeah. you're not, yeah. that sounds intense.
Yeah.
And
No, I don't know. I really like backpacking. I haven't been in a while. I really like backpacking. And then I like being outside. I like being with my family.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having fun right now.
Good. Like good, we are too. Yeah.
Like, I'm from Rochester, Michigan.
Right.
Which I now understand to be downstate.
Yes.
Because we just call you guys up north.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
And so I'm back in Michigan. I mean, it's just like, I really love this too. And that's the interesting thing is that my medical career is now affected by Paul's book. And now I'm speaking nationally about end of life care too. And then doctors are listening to me talk in their language about what it's like to be a patient, which is really interesting because I'm now going to medical conferences and they could invite any patient to speak. But then since I can say it in medical words, I go
sure.
and say it like that. But then really, I'm not talking about the stuff you write in the medical chart. I'm
right.
talking about all the other stuff you don't write in the medical chart.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like really compelling to doctors too,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's really interesting and great. I love it.
When Paul, tell us about, you were grieving when Paul passed away, obviously, mm-hmm. you know. to the point, I think, where at one point you went to his grave near Santa Cruz and took a nap. Mm-hmm. You write very beautifully about that. Can you tell us about that sleep and how it was different from the other naps you'd taken?
Yeah,
and,
sure. Yeah. So that was in this essay I wrote in the New York Times called My Marriage Didn't End When I Became a Widow. And it's about the ways in which your connections to that person continue even after they die. And, you know, like your feelings of love, or your feeling, for me, this feeling of like obligation or support through carrying the book through and stuff like that. And so in the weeks after Paul died, I just wasn't sleeping well, which I'm sure other people who are going through grief or have can relate to. And I went to his grave, and I just felt sort of compelled. And it's a really beautiful spot. It's like in this really pretty field, and you can see the Pacific Ocean, and it's a lovely place to be. It's sort of relaxing even just to be there. And I felt really compelled to like lie down on the ground on top of the grave, because it's like I was so used to sleeping in Paul's arms next to Paul, and that was sort of like the place where Paul is now. So it's like I'm literally just like lying on the ground wishing that Paul was closer. And and I fell asleep, which is something I just like couldn't do, for, you know, it's very hard. And I slept really well. That I took a nap, and I didn't expect it, but it was just sort of striking because it was really interesting. It's just such a weird, you know, I never thought I would be sleeping on a grave, you know, but it's just like, it's stuff like that. It just surprises you, you know, you never know what's going to feel good, and it's just moving target. And, you know, I had this really terrible, I was telling you this morning, I had this really terrible tingling in my hand after Paul died. And I was like, I'm coping pretty well. I'm like, I have a new baby and I'm taking really good care of her, and I'm working on the book, which made me feel really good and connected. I loved it. But I had this terrible tingling in my hands, and then I'm having these catastrophic thoughts because, you know, I'm really sad and I'm anxious in these new roles. And I was like, too bad, I have a debilitating neurological disease now, and I'm not gonna be, my dad's in the audience and he's probably just like, yeah, that is what you were saying. And, but I really was like, this couldn't just be grief. Wouldn't it be great if it were just grief? But it's so severe, and it's like this real tingling. And then a year after Paul died, I just woke up one day and I just didn't have it anymore. I just, you know, I'd had tingling in my hands for a year. And so it's just interesting the way that grief is so heavy, and there's all these things you wouldn't expect, like the tingling, you know. I don't know, I don't even know how that happens, you know.
Have you always been like that? Just accepting things that happen? Because I've noticed, you know, as we've been talking, you know, you'll say, you know what, I don't know, in 5 minutes I might feel differently, or it might be 5 years. Mm-hmm. Was that always you?
Not necessarily. I think I used to get more frustrated about a lot of stuff.
So maybe the process of what we're talking about elicited that change in you?
Is I that think so. I think I just sort of, and maybe it was practicing medicine too, I just was like, suffering just is a part of our lives. And it's just like, we just... Meanwhile, suffering is an invitation to love each other, you know, and be loved. And that's what happened in our family, too. And so, I don't know, I think I just sort of accept the fact it's all kind of swirled together, and I'm okay with it.
It's really profound. Would you say that again? What is suffering? No, seriously.
Yeah.
Suffering is an invitation to
love and be loved.
Wow.
To love.
So maybe it's not suffering. I mean, I don't know. I mean, what do you think? I mean,
it's life.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. Tell us, and then we'll maybe have you read one more section and then go to questions about because when you were talking, I just realized, so Paul has passed away, but yet you have to finish the book. And you must feel this immense sense of burden, like, I've got to publish this book. What do you do? What is that process like? You're alone. I mean, I imagine you walking into your office or the home, and there sits his pile of pages on a desk. And you, right?
Yeah.
And you're looking at them like, what do I do? How do I come close to that?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
So the emotional piece of it did not feel like a burden, but it felt urgent.
Right.
Like, it felt like I would be crushed if I couldn't do it, you know? And meanwhile, he had already secured the book deal. So there was an editor at Random House, Andy Ward, who's amazing, sure. And then his agent, Dorian Karchmar. And so I was on the phone with both of them the morning after he died.
Really?
Yeah, and I was like, I have some really bad news to tell you. I'd never spoken with either of them on the phone before, Paul had. And then I said, can this still be a book? You know, is it long enough? Is it okay? And it was a Word document on Paul's computer. So it's like the cursor is just flashing and it's like just sitting there, like you say. And
not where he actually ends in the book, but I mean, it was kind of a piece.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Andy Ward used to be at GQ.
Yeah, that's right.
He's an amazing editor.
Oh, he's so awesome and he's really humble. He's just like really wise.
You were in great hands, yeah.
Yeah, he was the best. And now he feels like a family member and he never met Paul in person and that's like mind-boggling to me because he knows him inside out. And then the interesting task was Andy asked us to send him all of Paul's writing that we could find that wasn't in the manuscript. And it was because Paul had sort of been writing this book his whole life. He was, like I said, very interested in mortality as a philosophical and existential challenge. And then it became an emotional challenge when he was sick. But he had a master's thesis about it, and he had all of these other essays, and he had this series of emails back and forth to his best friend, Robin, and they would try to kind of outdo each other with these really deep, beautiful, and sometimes funny emails. And they wouldn't say any of this stuff out loud to each other, they'd just make jokes. And then when they were apart, Robin lived in Singapore, they had this like beautiful epistolary relationship, and they just like wrote. So Robin sent emails to Andy, and then Andy lifted out little pieces of these writings and supplemented the manuscript with them. But I was giving permission to do that and saying where I thought Paul would think it would make sense. Mm-hmm. And that was a very urgent, like emotionally urgent and really, I did feel as if I always could intuit what would have made sense to Paul. But the book looks somewhat different from the manuscript, but again, like the arc of it, all of it, is essentially not different at all. There's just like certain paragraphs that flesh out an idea a little bit more, or there's a section in the book about anatomy lab, and it's not very different. It's like, this is Paul's mm-hmm. book, obviously, and it's all his writing, but there's a section where Paul wrote, insert anatomy lab essay in these little brackets,
right.
And that's this piece about, he's talking about the reverse polarity of the mannequins and the cadavers when you take a CPR class and when you dissect a body and how dissecting a body, it's really good, it's cool. And the dissecting a body, you try to pretend the body's fake. And in the CPR class, you try to pretend the mannequin's real. And how kind of weird that is. And what does that say about changing from a student into a doctor as you develop the ability to do that, for better or worse. So I was like, I know what that essay is. He wrote that in medical school. I can get you that essay,
sure.
And then you can insert it. So there was a lot of stuff that was like that.
Wow, he's so lucky to have, I mean, you as the kind of partner in that, in the vision of that.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting as you talk, it raises the question, so what can art do that science can't?
Mm.
Because Paul seems to have been consumed by both.
Mm-hmm.
And the great irony here seems to be that science couldn't save him, but art did in a way.
Ooh.
You know?
Yeah. Right. This was like redemptive.
Right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And not that science failed.
Right.
But the conclusion is we don't get out of this alive, mm-hmm. no matter.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, that's what I admire. One of the things I admire about this book is the fact that he actually, I think, kind of tacitly makes that argument.
Uh-huh.
Or understands it.
Yeah, yeah. After he died, there was a newspaper headline that said, renowned Stanford neurosurgeon Paul Kalanithi succumbs to lung cancer. And I was like, he did not succumb to lung cancer. Like, he died.
Right.
But it's like you're saying, yeah. He was still, like, yeah.
Would you read a section? Anything you'd like?
Yeah, sure, okay. I'm going to read. I actually haven't read this particular section out loud before.
That book has been all over the country, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, okay, so this is talking about, he's talking about religion, and then he's just is talking about, like, what does faith mean, and the fact that, of course, you can't prove anything about faith, and that's the point of faith. And then, and he had this sort of complicated relationship with religion, and he writes about it in the book. And I think it's funny because, you know, neurosurgeons and atheists come up to me and say, or physicians, and they say, this guy gets me, this is our guy. And then, like, faithful Christians come up to me and they say, this guy gets me, this is our guy. And, like, it just, it's really interesting, and I think it goes to show, like, Paul's just, like, searching and raw, and he's writing about science and he's writing about religion, but he's not writing it at all strategically. He's not trying to change anybody's mind. He's just writing about his own struggle. And I think, you know, it's a struggle, and that's what people are relating to, I think. But he's talking about that, and he says, the paradox is that scientific methodology is the product of human hands and thus cannot reach some permanent truth. We build scientific theories to organize and manipulate the world, to reduce phenomena into manageable units. Science is based on reproducibility and manufactured objectivity. As strong as that makes its ability to generate claims about matter and energy, it also makes scientific knowledge inapplicable to the existential, visceral nature of human life, which is unique and subjective and unpredictable. Science may provide the most useful way to organize empirical, reproducible data, but its power to do so is predicated on its inability to grasp the most central aspects of human life: hope, fear, love, hate, beauty, envy, honor, weakness, striving, suffering, virtue. Between these core passions and scientific theory, there will always be a gap. I could keep going, but it's really, like, it's nice. And then he's, at the end, he says, he's talking, yeah, okay, so it's, in the end, it cannot be doubted that each of us can see only a part of the picture. The doctor sees one, the patient another, the engineer a third, the economist a fourth, the pearl diver a fifth, the alcoholic a sixth, the cable guy a seventh, the sheep farmer an eighth, the Indian beggar a ninth, the pastor a tenth. Human knowledge is never contained in one person. It grows from the relationships we create between each other and the world, and still it is never complete. And truth comes somewhere above all of them, where at the end of that Sunday's reading, and then he's quoting this biblical passage, the sower and reaper can rejoice together, for here the saying is verified that one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap what you have not worked for. Others have done the work, and you are sharing the fruits of their work.
Well, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Lucy Kalanithi talking with Doug Stanton. Lucy's late husband, Paul Kalanithi, wrote the memoir, When Breath Becomes Air. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerrick.